Welcome to The Point. I'm Indy Todd. Later in the hour, we check in with biologist and educator Michael DeSpezio to get the latest on the science of the coronavirus, including advances in therapies and where we stand on vaccine development. But first, Labor Day has long marked the unofficial end of the summer season on the Cape and Islands, a good time to check in on the impacts the pandemic has had on the local economy and how businesses can best take advantage of the shoulder season. Joining us is Julian Sear, state senator for the Cape and Islands, also chair of the Cape and Islands Reopening Task Force. Welcome back.
Good morning, Mindy. Good to be with you.
So, Julian, in April and May, the big question was, will we have a summer season on the Cape and Islands? So how did the summer season pan out for local businesses? And let's start with hotels and motels and short-term rentals. They pretty much did fill up, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think all Cape Codders and Islanders, I think now that we're post-Labor Day, certainly know and saw that we had a season here. And it was a much more vibrant season than I think I certainly expected, and I think most of us expected when we were, you know, kind of coming out of that surge from April and early May in cases that we saw and cautiously moving into reopening. You know, I think many of us predicted a muted summer, and I think it was a muted summer on a number of metrics, but it was a heck of a lot busier than I think was expected at the outset. When we look at occupancy, and I should say we don't have occupancy data tends to lag a little bit. We rely on revenue data on room occupancy, but hotel occupancy from mid-August when we did a snapshot was at 88% of what it was in 2019. That's actually not that bad. And anecdotally, I know people who, you know, friends and colleagues were shooting me notes saying, hey, you know, I want to come down to the Cape. I can't find a place. So I think, especially from an occupancy perspective, people wanted to get away, and they saw Cape Cod as a safe and close destination where they could do that.
Yeah. Now, early on, restaurants had to scramble to switch to takeout if they could, and then outdoor seating if they could find the space. So how did restaurants fare this season?
So again, we're still, you know, waiting for a number of those sort of like hard data points. You know, meals tax revenue gives you a good snapshot, and that data tends to lag. But broadly, I think for restaurants face a number of challenges. You know, and I'm someone who, you know, grew up in this business, and so I understand intimately, you know, just the work to, you know, change your systems and retrain your staff. There was a number of kind of challenges that were faced by those businesses. Workforce was a big one. A number of restaurants would close one or two days a week, in part because they just didn't have the staff to sort of fully sort of staff up like they would in a normal season. There was a huge demand for outdoor dining, and certainly a number of reports of less consumer demand for indoor dining. I think there's a really big question about how late are restaurants able to stay open. I think many restaurants, a number of restaurants, I think, I expect saw a loss this season. We know across Massachusetts, 20% of restaurants have closed permanently, and that some of that is the case here. Though I think we will not see the full effect of the pandemic and the economic crisis on our restaurant industry, I think, until next season. I'm really curious to see what next April and May looks like. Who's opening back up and who isn't?
Right. Well, talking about the workers, did we have any J-1 or H-2B visa workers here this summer?
So there were some. It depends on how the visa program works. So the H-2B program, this is the program that a number of folks from Jamaica and other countries, you know, come here to work. It's a three-year visa. So a number of these workers, you know, are on Cape Cod or Nantucket or Martha's Vineyard for the summer, and then maybe they go to a winter resort destination like Stowe, Vermont, and work there in the off-season. So those folks are sort of in-country, able to return to the Cape. Folks who were out of country was more difficult. So
yeah.
The J-1 program took a significant hit. There were some J-1 visa students here, but there was far less less J-1 workers. A number of the business owners, especially restaurateurs that I talked to, you know, had a smaller staff, but also their operations were scaled back. So in the best case scenario, there's a bit of a right sizing around the workforce piece. So we saw a lot of H-2B workers, less J-1, given how the programs are structured.
And didn't we have a lot more local young people available? Because, you know, a lot of the colleges, you know, are doing remote. And, you know, normally at this time of year, businesses are struggling to find anybody to help out. But we have a lot of young people still at home because they're, you know, doing remote learning. So in this sort of shoulder season, are we finding that the seasonal businesses have enough workers?
So, again, we don't have sort of hard data to say definitively what's happening. But I think anecdotally, the sense, both from seasonal workers who maybe were college students who were, you know, returning to college, or friends of mine, right, who maybe spend the summer waiting on tables in P-Town and then, you know, go to New York or someplace warm in the winter. You know, we're seeing a number of reports of people who are staying here, whether that's because school is remote or because I think they made the determination that the season could be a little bit longer here, that they want to stay in this community for a number of reasons. And are planning to ride out the pandemic here. So I'm not hearing the traditional crush of, you know, you get to the middle, end of August, and a whole chunk of your workforce leaves to go back to school,
right,
and you're sort of limping into August. I've heard less of that, and I think that is a function of the pandemic. Again, we don't sort of have hard data to definitively say what's going on yet.
Yeah, a lot of anecdotal evidence right now. So now unemployment rates on the Cape and Islands do tend to rise in the off season and decline in the summer season. But COVID-19 impacted a number of different employment sectors in our region. How has it impacted businesses that aren't typically seasonal in nature, like healthcare, education, and social services?
So, you know, if for healthcare and social services, just an unprecedented demand with a real drop in revenue. So, you know, if you speak to Cape Cod Healthcare or to the community health centers, they, starting in mid-March, they saw very few, if any, patients who were not coming in for treatment related to COVID-19. That has resulted in a whopping revenue gap that is going to have ramifications for, certainly for Cape Cod Healthcare, the community health centers, and really every healthcare provider in Massachusetts and across the country. And we just saw that, right, with a round of layoffs that unfortunately Cape Cod Hospital was, Cape Cod Healthcare, rather, was needed to do. I think for folks in social services, especially agencies who rely and administer federal grants and state grants, there's a lot of waiting and uncertainty of what's going to happen in the state budget. What sort of federal support are we going to get from Congress? If you look at what the House of Representatives passed, if that came to fruition, Massachusetts would get about $10 billion in aid related to COVID-19 and the economic recovery. We think we need about $6 billion. If the Senate plan passed, we'd get about $2.5, maybe $3 billion of that dollars. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of uncertainty in social services wondering, you know, are we going to see a number of cuts coming from state programs and federal programs? And we just don't know that yet. I mean, frankly, we're all sort of waiting to see what action Congress takes.
Yeah. We're talking about the impacts of the pandemic on the local economy with Senator Julian Cyr, who's also the chair of the Cape and Islands Reopening Task Force. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Art establishments, particularly theaters and smaller museums, are hurting, along with fitness centers and gyms. What are you hearing from those organizations and businesses about their viability going forward?
So there's just a tremendous amount of uncertainty. Certainly, you know, our cultural sector, which, you know, here on Cape Cod and the islands is very vibrant. You know, many of these organizations were unable to open. You know, those that did opened late. Certainly have restrictions, particularly those that aren't sort of outdoor activity, you know, have an outdoor component. A number of restrictions, I think, are really going to have a significant impact. The Cape Cod Commission, as part of the task force work, conducted a business impact survey. And broadly what that survey found is that businesses and organizations that rely on guests physically coming into their spaces, right? So say you're an art museum or a restaurant only with indoor dining, that those are the organizations that have seen the biggest decline in revenue and are financially in the most precarious position. So that would apply to cultural organizations, especially those, you know, you're going to a theater, you're going to the museum, most of that happens indoors, and so that would track with the declining revenue.
Yeah. In early August, Governor Baker initiated a mandatory 14-day quarantine for people coming into Massachusetts from states who have increasing rates of infection. And for a while, only those traveling from New York, Connecticut, Maine, Vermont, New Hampshire, New Jersey could enter the state without quarantine. Do we know if that quarantine had an impact on the local economy?
So we don't fully know. I think the good news with this, with the travel advisory, especially the more recent travel advisory that's been in effect since August, was that the vast majority of our visitors to Cape Cod and the islands are coming from neighboring or regional states. So, you know, nearly 60% of our visitors come from New England states, including Massachusetts, and about another 20% come from the New York, New Jersey area. So most of our sort of core visitors, the folks who come here, you know, in normal times, are coming from these neighboring states. And so I think it had less of an impact financially than having restrictions for other states like Florida or states in the South. We just don't see a lot of visitors there. What it did create is it created a huge host of hassles and headaches for the folks who are taking reservations, who are booking rooms, and actually the policy sort of prior to the August policy, which essentially was there's a travel advisor in Massachusetts, you need to quarantine for 14 days, but there's no enforcement, you know, sort of good luck, created a lot of confusion and I think headache for folks in the hospitality sector, especially accommodations. And so I found the updated travel guidance that has been in place since August provided more clarity, right? If you weren't from one of those states, if you couldn't get a COVID test, then you could cancel. And the one place where we saw huge demand was in accommodations, as I said earlier. So yeah. Most of those accommodations were able to be rebooked by folks coming from either within Massachusetts or other New England Northeast states.
Yeah. I know you probably don't have any hard data on this, but it seems like the housing market is booming at the moment. And there are a lot of people who are choosing to stay who normally, you know, because they are be able to work remotely or the kids don't have to go back to school, they're able to do that. It seems to be a little bit busier beyond Labor Day than we normally see. And like I said, housing market seems to be doing really well.
The housing market is, you know, we already had sort of this out of whack, market sort of geared towards, you know, second, third homes. And the demand for these homes has just gone through the roof. So if you look at inventory of all the new housing inventory that was put on the market in July, by August, 60% of that was under contract, meaning that folks were putting in offers, were getting homes under contract. And there's such a demand. We've not really kept up with housing production here on Cape Cod and on the islands. I would argue that housing is sort of one of the biggest crises we face as a region. I think that, you know, the coming fall and winter and the after effects of the pandemic provide opportunity for Cape Cod and for the islands because we're going to have people who are realizing, you know, hey, look, I can make a life here and I can work remotely. But I also really fear that it's going to exacerbate the housing crisis that we have. And so for Cape Codders, especially, you know, folks who work in our hospitality industry, people who make a life here year-round, I really worry that this is only going to exacerbate the crisis we have. I think we need to double down on housing production. This is absolutely was a crisis before the pandemic. I think it's only going to get worse. And I think that's really where our focus is. The good news is we've got housing advocates, the Realtors Association, you know, a number of other folks sort of really pushing, a single message that we need to continue to be very serious about housing needs for Cape Codders and Islanders.
Mm. So as we head into the fall, do you have a sense of how retail establishments and restaurants are preparing themselves for the change of season and the potential to having to move indoors?
So we're doing everything we can to really push sort of the second summer. And for locals, you know, we know that September arguably is the best time here. And really it stays quite nice through October and November. So I think first and foremost, just trying to sort of keep up, keep up some business activity now while the weather's nice. I think when it comes to, you know, what do we actually do when it's actually cold here, those are individual decisions that businesses are trying to figure out. I think some of them are saying, you know, hey, look, we're not able to sort of keep up outdoor dining. Of course, when it's cold, we're going to close. I think others are trying to get creative, you know, and so I think it's on a case-by-case basis. Mm-hmm. We do know, particularly when it relates to retail establishments or other activities, you know, wearing a face covering, a mask that covers your nose and mouth is very, very effective at preventing the spread of COVID-19. And so hopefully, you know, those sort of activities, whether it's retail or, you know, visiting a place where you're able to wear that mask, hopefully that'll allow folks to stay open. But, you know, we really rely on, you know, small business is not only the backbone, it's sort of the entire economy down here. Mm-hmm. And yeah. I think individual businesses are just trying to figure out how they're going to get through and how do they try to make it to next season. And hopefully, you know, by next summer, we do have a season. I really worry about what will happen if we're still in the midst of this pandemic next mm-hmm. summer. You know, having two muted seasons back to back will be truly devastating, I think, for a number of businesses and a number of workers.
So what are your expectations then for the shoulder season economy this year?
I think we're going to see a lot of folks continuing to take day trips. You know, we saw this as early as May and into early June, even before things were opening up, that, you know, Cape Cod's a place you can drive to, especially in Massachusetts and in New England. You can drive for the day. You can come down for the weekend. I think there's more flexibility in people's work schedules, especially for those who are able to work remotely. So I think actually we will see a bit of a season, particularly in, you know, while the weather stays nice. I think the big uncertainty is sort of what happens as things get cold, and also what decisions the individual businesses and workers make around how late they're able to stay open. Many businesses have been taking a loss. So if you continue to stay open, you know, it can, you know, you can just sort of further that loss. So I'm curious to see what decisions businesses make. You know, how they're able to sort of figure out how late do they stay open. And this is always a conversation here in my family's business. It was always a conversation, you know, do we stay open to Columbus Day? Do we stay open longer? Do we close sooner? So these are sort of the normal conversations that business owners in Cape Cod sort of have every year. I think COVID-19 really sort of complicates matters. And, you know, there's examples of restaurants, for instance, that did quite well in the pandemic. And there's a number of others, I think more so, that have really struggled in this. And so I think it remains to be seen what this actually looks like. But I do expect we'll continue to see folks here because, you know, domestic travel is, you know, domestic close-by travel to a place that's safe with ample natural beauty, with a lot of wind and light and, you know, a lot of those natural assets. You know, that's something we really have to offer, and I think people are looking for that. Mm.
Julian Sear is the state senator for the Cape and Islands and the chair of the Cape and Islands Reopening Task Force. Julian, thanks for taking time to talk with us this morning. Appreciate it.
Always good to be with you. Take care.
Coming up after a break, the latest on the science of the coronavirus, including where we stand with a vaccine. You're listening to The Point. We shift gears slightly now to take a look at the science of the coronavirus. Joining us is Michael DeSpezio, biologist, educator, and science author. He's developed a website and blog on the science of the coronavirus. Michael DeSpezio, welcome back. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, now, Michael, in the spring, it wasn't entirely clear how the coronavirus was spreading person to person. You know, was it on living on surfaces? Could it be in our groceries or mail? The good news is that we have a much better understanding. So describe how coronavirus spreads and what measures we should be taking to slow or stop that spread.
Yes, we do have a better understanding of the virus, but one needs to see and appreciate this is still really new science, which is continually evolving, and our thoughts, our understanding of the virus continually changes. When we were first studying the spread, there was a major focus on transmission through contact with surfaces that were contaminated by the virus. So if somebody would sneeze, there'd be droplets, fallout, which would land on a surface. If you touch the surface, then touch your mouth or your nose, then the virus would be transferred to you. And we placed a very large emphasis on that being the major route. The more and more that scientists have learned about how this virus spreads, the more it points to the fact that the virus is spreading in droplets and in even smaller droplets called aerosols. Now, what that is all about is that, say, someone sneezes, or if somebody speaks, or if somebody sings, or if they cough, what you're doing is introducing virus particles, the SARS-CoV-2 virus, which is going out from your body. You're shedding the virus. And if someone comes in direct contact with that shed through the aerosols, through the droplets, then that person can become infected if they get an infectious dose of the virus. So it's getting back to how one best protects themselves. Social distancing is critical. It is critical to place the distance, because if we think now, if the primary route of spread or an increased focus on the spread coming from aerosols, one wants to set a distance between you and another person in case that person is spreading the virus. Also, face masks become very important. Now, initially and still on a number of sites, they suggest wearing a face mask to protect others, which certainly you do. If you're infected and you would sneeze, obviously you would broadcast these droplets out into your environment. However, the research shows that this also protects the user. Although we may not have the N95 masks, the super effective masks in stopping you becoming infected by breathing in these particles, masks do help you by establishing a physical barrier. Not only through filter size through the pores, but also, believe it or not, it's through electrostatic, and that sounds kind of fancy, electrostatic capture, where, you know, if you would charge up a balloon on your head and then it seems to stick to the wall, the same way these high-end N95 masks can cause virus particles to stick to them, so it would prevent them from going into the people who legitimately have access to these higher-end protective devices.
So obviously we should still be washing our hands and disfecting surfaces.
Doing that because that is still believed to be a major method or a major venue for transfer, that you're going to be able to get this virus if you touch a contaminated surface, bring it up. However, and it was interesting, Fauci was talking about this a few weeks ago, that yes, virus particles can exist outside of the body. They can exist for several days. However, the current belief, increasing in what we're seeing in the studies, in case studies, in laboratory data, is that you need a certain load of virus. You need an infectious dose of virus for your body to become really infected by the virus. Although you can take the virus in, you need a higher load. The current belief is that when virus lands on a surface, you touch the surface, you bring that to your mouth or your nose, you are not introducing a high enough load of virus to become infected. Which gets me into one other thing. We talk about immunity. We talk about two types of immunity. Obviously, we're looking at vaccines to give us this acquired immunity, that we're going to get immunity from the virus. And this is not only antibodies, but also boosting our T cells, which are immune cells which help us organize our defenses against pathogens, against these foreign germs. But what we're winding up doing now is making sure that we can defend ourselves against these virus particles. I'm sorry, you were just saying, I just lost.
Yeah, no, I was asking you, just talking about the disinfecting surfaces, before we get to vaccines, how does one properly disinfect a surface? We hear different things on what is, the best thing to
great.
Use.
Great. That is a great, great question. There are various ways to do it. My suggestion is to go to the CDC site, the Centers for Disease Control. You're going to be able to find a number of pieces that reference the proper ways to disinfect. And so you're going to want to take a look at the surface. How do you clean a surface? Remember, cleaning a surface is different from disinfection. Disinfection involves getting rid of germs. Cleaning it means getting rid of the particles that are on the surface. But you're going to get more specifics. And I always believe in pointing to the people who have the best and the most recent information available. So if you go to the CDC site and look at disinfection, you'll see it. In the past, we've looked at maybe 60 to 70% alcohol solutions for using as a disinfectant. How do you best disinfect? Again, take a look at the site, because the site not only goes into disinfection, but it goes into cleaning. Should you be vacuuming? Mm-hmm. Should going back, when one goes back to a school, should all the carpets be vacuumed? Should the carpets be taken up? This is a very involved, a very involved subject. And as I said, I am not an expert on that. And I want to point to the experts, and I want to point to the CDC site for really culling all this information together. So if you want to know how best to disinfect, how best to clean, that would help reduce the risk of transmitting COVID-19, please go to that site.
Okay. All right, so let's talk about vaccine development and the latest. How did yesterday's halt to the phase 3 trial of the Oxford vaccine impact vaccination development?
Oh, boy. That is kind of a major beat. And notice I'm calling it a beat because we have to reflect about it. For those who were not aware of what happened, is that yesterday in the phase 3 testing, and phase 3 testing really is a large number of subjects, thousands that we're looking at, receive the vaccine and some receive the placebo. And it is a major test to see how effective, how safe the vaccine is among a large number of people. What happened yesterday is that an individual, and it's believed the individual was probably in a testing site out in UK, and although their symptoms really are not publicized, what they had, what I did find out was it might be an inflammatory syndrome that affects the spinal cord, which is sparked by viral infections. This person seemed to have those symptoms, which caused the phase 3 trial on this AstraZeneca, also called the Oxford vaccine, since it was developed out in Oxford, to be halted. Now, we don't know whether this was an event which was related to the vaccine or was separate, because somebody could come down with a disorder which is not related to getting that vaccine. So what has happened now is that the trial is on hold. My guess is within 3 or 4 days, we should have more information about specifically what occurred, what the symptoms were, where they most likely, or what was the most likely trigger to cause this, if it is indeed an inflammatory syndrome. Now, it's interesting because this syndrome, if it is that, it is sparked by viral infections. And looking at the Oxford vaccine, by the way, is one of the new generation of nucleic acid vaccines. Specifically, it is the Oxford one is a DNA vaccine. And DNA, if you remember back from your biology classes, really is the book which contains the blueprints for making proteins, for making virus particles, for making everything. And what we do with this vaccine is we introduce the blueprints for making parts of the virus into a person. And that person's cells gets the blueprints, makes those virus parts, which are spike proteins, just parts of the virus. Your body reacts to the presence of those foreign particles and builds up its immune response. So when the actual virus appears, you are already prepped. Your body is revved up with all of these antibodies that can quickly deactivate the virus before it takes hold in your body. Now, the Oxford vaccine, which makes it different from the other forerunners in phase 3, is that it uses a weakened chimpanzee virus to introduce that DNA blueprint. So possibly the reaction wasn't to the blueprint itself, but possibly to that virus, which is attenuated, which means it's weakened. It's a chimpanzee virus, which is weakened, which then works as the ferry, works as the carrier of that DNA, which infects our cell, and our cell makes the virus spike protein, and then our body reacts to that presence. So who knows? We don't know enough about it, but we're going to be learning, I'm sure, more about this within the next few days.
So let me ask you, there's a number of vaccine developers. So did the U.S. companies work in collaboration Do U.S. companies work in collaboration with vaccine developers in other countries, or are we doing our own thing?
Great, great question. Yes, we do. There's a number of different vaccines that are in different phases, phase three, will occur. For example, the Oxford vaccine is being tested in a number of countries, including the U.S. Just a few weeks ago, I believe the trial started up in the U.S., and they're trying to enlist thousands of people in this. So I'm not sure at what stage the U.S. is, how many numbers of people, but we have started them in the U.S. So what will happen often is that different countries that are coming up with new vaccines will have their trials occur not only in their own country, but in other countries around the world.
So we've been hearing that we could have a vaccine as soon as November. Is that, what are your thoughts on that?
You know, interesting question. We are moving really at light speed in getting these vaccines out there. If you look at, you know, Fauci's quotes from maybe about 3 months, 4 months ago, you know, he was saying that, you know, there's a possibility by the end of the year that we might have a viable vaccine. Nobody wants to set a time on, we're going to definitely have it by this date, by November 1st, we've got it, because you need to make sure that these vaccines are not only effective, but they're also safe. So we're looking at vaccines which are in phase three trials. I know that there has been a number of vaccines in China and Russia which have already been released in kind of limited approval, early use, and we've got questions about their safety because they haven't completed the phase three, which is needed to really see if these vaccines are safe. We don't know if the vaccine is going to set off something such as maybe an over-response of the immune system to the appearance of the virus. And certainly that over-response of the immune system is what causes the most deadly symptoms of COVID-19. We certainly don't want to introduce that. Plus, we have experience with other vaccines. People point back to 1970s when we looked at the swine flu vaccine, which was released, and the problems that it caused. So, yes, we've got to be really careful, sure that these vaccines are safe, that they're out there, because also you have to remember that they are not, although they're being given to humans, the humans are not then introduced to the active virus again. That's a whole other step, and that can get into a whole discussion on the ethics of whether or not you introduce a virus to somebody who might be immune when we still, at this point, we still don't know all of the effects and the impact that SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19, has on a person's health.
We're talking with Michael DeSpezio, biologist, educator, and science author. He's developed a website and blog on the science of the coronavirus. We'll have more after a break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Michael DeSpezio, biologist, educator, and science author. He's developed a website and blog on the science of the coronavirus. Our number, if you'd like to join the conversation, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Michael, we've been really encouraged to get flu shots this season. Why is getting a flu shot more important this year than in previous years?
Oh, that's another great question. First of all, it's important because there are still some misconceptions out there that COVID-19 may be a type of flu. It is not. There are two separate types of pathogens. Yeah, they're both RNA viruses. However, it's important to stay as healthy as one can. Again, we don't know what is going to happen. There's something in biology called synergistic effects, when two things begin to impact each other. And we don't know what is going to happen if indeed we get the numbers of COVID-19 cases rising again as we get into the fall, plus we have the seasonal flu out there. So it's important for one to protect themselves against the seasonal flu. Now, the seasonal flu vaccine most likely will not protect you against COVID-19. There are some papers that I read earlier that suggested that. Most likely not, because it's protecting you really against those flu viruses. Now, if we're looking at going into the fall, the problems are, remember before we talked about that what is believed to be the primary method of spread is through aerosols, through droplets of people being in close proximity to each other, people not wearing masks. What happens is as we go into the fall, it begins to cool off, and no longer do we have the option or as many options to be outside. And I can tell you, when I am outside, I feel great in the sense that the virus is being diluted. Again, we don't know the exact concentration that one needs to be inhaling or getting into their body to become infected for it to establish infection. But if you're outside, the virus is diluted. Also, there is research that shows that UV light falling on the virus particles helps break them down. So again, if it might fall on surfaces that are outside, there's less of a chance of them surviving it if they're in direct sunshine. But again, these are all unknowns. We don't know the numbers. But what it's pointing to is when fall comes around, when we have that seasonal flu, and it's interesting because scientists still aren't sure why we have seasonal flu. Why does the flu seem to come back? There are all sorts of theories, but no one is in complete agreement on why this occurs. And one of those things is that we're inside again, and it's easier for the virus to spread. Now, not only will being inside be easier for the flu virus to spread, but also easier for the COVID-19 virus to spread. So as we get into the fall, you need to be careful of, you know, making sure that you're in a well-ventilated area, that you have significant distance, 6 feet or more from other people, that you are wearing protective face coverings. And so by following these suggestions, you can decrease your risk. And it's interesting because it's all about decreasing risk. Nobody can say that there is zero chance of you getting this. But following certain behaviors can lower your risk dramatically.
Yeah, and say you mentioned the flu and COVID-19 are different viruses, but they have similar symptoms, right? So
have respiratory symptoms. They attack the respiratory tract, and you know these symptoms. In the case of, let's say, COVID-19, they get even more serious. I might add something else about COVID-19 virus, which is interesting. The SARS-CoV-2 virus binds to certain cells in your body, and this is what makes you susceptible to infection. And these cells all have a landing pad, if you'd like, on their surface. And the landing pad is what's known as an ACE2 receptor. It's a type of protein that normally functions in regulating blood pressure, but it also works like the doorbell to get inside of a cell. Now, cells that have these receptors are found in the respiratory tract. They are also found in the digestive tract. So now people may ask, you know, if SARS-CoV-2 is indeed a respiratory virus, why are we shedding it in feces? Because there's been a lot of research on looking at that as maybe even a way of monitoring the spread of this virus. Well, the reason is that many of the cells in the digestive tract also have this ACE2 receptor, which means that the SARS can affect and impact these cells. Plus, cells that are in the heart also have these ACE2 receptors, which means that we can have problems. And people are seeing this not only in the lungs, which will have these receptors, but also in other body parts. And it's interesting because scientists, epidemiologists are trying to look at, well, does the number of receptors that one might have impact your likelihood or the severity of COVID-19, of getting COVID-19? And again, no one knows for certain. We have certain indications of things, but all of this data certainly is not, not absolute.
Right. So now we've heard of people getting reinfected with the virus, and the few documented cases show that when people are reinfected, it's with a slightly different strain of the virus. So what do we know about reinfection? Is it similar to, you know, how a flu can mutate? Are we thinking that the COVID-19 can mutate as well?
Exactly. You've got it there. And there were very few. I think there was a case in Hong Kong recently which really showed that there was a person who was infected, then they were reinfected, because what they then did was check the genome, check those blueprints of the reinfection, and they found them different from the blueprints of the original infection. Let's talk about viruses and why they change. As we mentioned before, viruses have blueprints. We have blueprints. We have blueprints in the form of DNA. Viruses, certainly this one, has its blueprints in the form of RNA. And these blueprints are apt to mutate. Now, it's kind of interesting because viruses actually have, among the proteins that they can make when they get into cells, they have the ability to make chemicals which check and make sure that their blueprints are correct, that there aren't any problems, and they'll go in there and they'll help change and correct those blueprints. But getting back to this, so the viruses have blueprints. Every time that a virus infects a cell, it takes over the cell. Its RNA will get into the cell, will take over the protein manufacturing sites. These are called ribosomes, and the ribosomes are stupid. They make protein. They'll make any sort of protein. Just give them a blueprint. And ordinarily, they would get the blueprint from the cell nucleus, and the proteins that they would make are used to sustain the living condition of that cell. When a virus infects the cell, it takes over that ribosome, and now what happens is that ribosome begins making the proteins needed to produce new virus particles. You also have a process which takes place where you begin to replicate the virus blueprint, because each of the new virus particles which is produced by an infected cell needs to have within its core new virus blueprints to infect the next cell. So what you're doing is you're replicating the viral RNA, and this is a very sloppy process which is prone to mutations. Various viruses have different rates of mutation. The good thing about what we've seen so far in mutations within the RNA of the COVID-19 virus is that the target sites that we're looking at to develop vaccines against, that spike protein, those areas of blueprint, the RNA for the virus, seems to be very conservative in its replication, which means that it is not changing greatly, which is a great thing. Because what happens in the case of flu, the reason why we keep needing to have new flu vaccines is that they have more mutations that are occurring in those surface proteins, those surface antigens. And we need to make sure that we have what we think is the best combination of antigens that would be out there, or we're developing a vaccine that would best target those antigens. So the good news with COVID-19 virus is that the mutation rate isn't great. However, it is certainly mutating. It is a slightly different form than what first appeared. You're able to track it by its genetic code. I mean, there are some great pieces on actually mapping the spread of the virus by looking at its genome, which is really that genetic code of the virus, and seeing how it's changed. And we're able to follow its spread back from when it originally entered the United States as both a West Coast invasion and also an East Coast invasion. So there were two most likely separate strains that came in. And once we start getting into strains and subspecies, when it gets into viruses, it gets difficult really to tease them apart. But let's just say that, yes, there are differences in the different SARS-CoV-2, the virus particles that are out there. They are slight. However, we are able to see organization of these blueprints based upon similarities among the different virus strains.
Yeah. We have a few minutes left. Rapid and frequent testing is one way that we can find the virus and stop the spread. And many colleges are testing students regularly using a saliva sample. How reliable is this testing? And do you think it'll become more widespread in the next few months?
Great. Now, if we're looking at the saliva testing, now there's a couple of things. Generally, the saliva testing still goes back to the PCR testing. There's a couple of different types of tests that are out there. The best test, the most reliable one that is out there, is called a PCR test. And what that does is it looks for the blueprints of that virus. The fancy thing, polymerase chain reaction. What it does is it looks. You take a sample, a throat swab sample from somebody, then the amount of virus that is in there is so small that you need to amplify that amount of virus, and that's where the PCR comes in. So we have this reaction which amplifies the amount, and then we're able to look for certain markers that are found on the blueprints of the virus. Real interesting way in which that's done. If you go to my website, I talk about the ways in which these occur. So that is the most accurate type of test. Now, there are some rapid tests that are coming out, and what these rapid tests do is that they don't look for the blueprint from the virus, which is very accurate, but instead they look for antigens, they look for proteins from the virus. Yep, they're good. However, they are not as accurate. In fact, they begin to lose their value, their use, if they're given too soon in the infection. Before a person can build up large enough quantities of virus, say they're initially exposed, and you give them one of these rapid tests, they may show negative. However, at the same time, if they were given that PCR test, they are more likely to show positive. So you've got a trade-off right there. Also, there's other ways of improving testing called pooling, where you're able to pool another number of samples. However, if the population begins to show high infection rates, you may, in the case of pooling, be doing more testing. Pooling is another interesting strategy which works great when the numbers of infection are low. However, if the number of infections are higher, it is not that great. And then finally, you have those the blood antibody tests. And what you're doing in that is not looking for active infection. You're looking for the body's response to the virus which had at one time appeared in that person. You know, in some people, you might be able to see an active virus infection if their antibodies really were produced quickly, and you might be able to see both active infection and the antibodies. But in most cases, when people are tested with the antibodies, they are indicative that that person was previously exposed to the COVID-19 virus. Now, from that, you know, there's a number of things. People are looking at convalescent plasma and also being able to use the plasma of people who have been infected and take a look at the antibodies that are in there and deriding other types of therapeutics to fight the virus in people. And let me mention one more thing, because recently there's another positive that has come up in the research on therapies, and that has to do with looking at steroid treatment. We're looking at certain steroids which can improve people's health, especially those that enter the most severe stages of COVID-19 infection.
Yeah, just, Michael, just all talks about how complicated this issue is. And Michael DeSpezio is a biologist, educator, and science author. And he's developed a website and a blog on the science of the coronavirus. And we will have a link to that at our website, capeandislands.org. Michael, again, thanks for taking time to bring us up to date on the latest. We appreciate it.
Okay, thanks so much.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.